of her income because of the war.
Right.
If you could talk about this.
Yeah, she's a very good example, but one of actually the more privileged people that I read and I've translated. So let's just start with, by one estimate, last year, 30% of the population was under the poverty line. As you mentioned, the estimate currently is that 40% are just in this basically 40 days. We don't know what the actual numbers are going to be. We have to wait for the dust to settle to see what that percentage actually is. By one account, the price of goods, just everyday food items, has more than doubled in the 40 days. People have been laid off of jobs, not because of any kind of, I don't know, restructuring. But when you hit these supposed military targets, none of them are actually, some of them are military targets. Some of them are within a complex. They employ, let's say, 20,000 households. When that factory or that complex goes away, these 20,000 households are also now going to not have any jobs. So people are losing their jobs. People's are losing their homes. Food prices are going up. And that is also partly what, for example, the one that you mentioned, but something like something that I translated about 2 days ago by a woman named Zahra, where she talks about them being bombed. The bomb falls near their house. She loses her hearing. And then there's just one line in there, and she says, I lost my job today. And there's nothing more in that, because there nothing needs to be more said in that. And the question is, again, even if this ceasefire holds, how they're going to pull this country out of the situation, considering the fact that the protests that started in December were economic protests initially. They become political protests by January. But this istisal that I already talked about, at its heart, at its root, is also an economic question. And the war has just made it worse. And people's testimonies about that just prove that it has.
Professor Sadiri Boulougerdi, if you could comment on one of the points that Professor Sorabi raised, which has been the subject of some discussion and controversy, namely what has happened as a result of the assassination of so many of Iran's top leaders. You wrote in a recent piece, quote, the decapitation of the leadership has not produced capitulation. That, of course, is clear. And you say, if anything, it has arguably accelerated the consolidation of power in the hands of a younger and more militant generation within the political and security elite. So if you could elaborate on that and what precisely this more hardline and militant position may mean for the future of Iran's relations with the U.S. and also its Gulf neighbors.
Yes, I think it might be useful to sort of actually connect that to something that Professor Sohrabi was also saying. So, I mean, I also study the impact of sanctions on Iran, and particularly we see since 2012, actually, when the Obama administration actually pursued so-called crippling sanctions and really sort of tried to shut Iran out of the global financial system, we have seen this steady growth and sort of immiseration of the Iranian populace, particularly obviously the working classes and lower middle classes. And this hasn't been linear. It has been relatively kind of uneven because the Iranian government has taken various measures to diminish that somewhat. But what we've seen is actually it has empowered those connected to the security apparatus and architecture within the state. It's what I use the term asymmetric statehood. So basically we see those elements that have access to black markets, smuggling and so on, have actually proven resilient, actually. And this is kind of a story which could characterize the Islamic Republic and the Iranian Revolution since 1979, the Iranian state, really. So we have obviously the baptism of fire in the form of the Iran-Iraq War. But then really, I mean, the Islamic Republic and Iran more broadly has always been facing, real sort of, I guess, imperial aggression, economic warfare, as well as actually outright warfare since its inception. And therefore, it has developed a significant resilience and has institutionalized that revolution as it ultimately was articulated and cashed out. So, the idea that if you just sort of decapitate the supreme leader, or you decapitate leading figures in the Revolutionary Guard. We're talking about a major, major institution. And the state more broadly, I mean, just beyond the Revolutionary Guards, I mean, there are multiple, a plurality of power centers within the Iranian state, which, you know, power can be, you know, is concentrated, obviously, in these, but it also is relatively diffused, even within the Revolutionary Guards. So just take, for instance, when we had the assassination again of leading military personnel on the 28th of February, Iran very quickly activated what's come to be known as its mosaic defense strategy, whereby you have this sort of decentralized command, which has been built over, you know, a significant period of time, whereby, you know, operations can continue even in the event of senior commanders being assassinated. And really, of course, this speaks to a broader strategy, a broader strategic horizon of, I mean, Iran in conventional terms, you know, under arms embargoes and sanctions, etc. I mean, it never was under the, you know, misapprehension that it could compete with the United States in conventional military terms. So it always has pursued this asymmetric an attritional strategy. And of course, I mean, this comes at a heavy, heavy cost for the country, for the population at large, and also even for the leadership. I mean, we've seen they've been hit very badly. But I guess the philosophy there is that they can actually withstand that because it obviously is an existential fight. They are prepared to weather and absorb that pain. And they kind of understand that the United States will come in like a bull in a china shop, basically unleash a huge amounts of destruction, but ultimately it'll be forced to withdraw because there simply isn't the appetite for a long, drawn-out campaign. And as I said, that's extremely costly for Iran. But, I mean, this is actually how they intend to weather the storm, and they don't really see that they have another option.
Well, let's step back and talk about one of the questions that you've raised in the several articles that you've written. You wrote in a London Review of Books article last month, we are witnessing the realization of a long-cherished ambition, a neoconservative fever dream that Benjamin Netanyahu has lobbied for in one form or another for decades. And in an article that you cited a quote from, the one by the CIA director calling Israel's concluding that regime change would occur in Iran, him calling it farcical. The New York Times, which reported this in a piece headlined How Trump Took the U.S. to War with Iran, it reported that Netanyahu, in his visit to the White House on February 11th, held a meeting in the Situation Room with Trump, as well as other senior military officials, including the CIA director, where he was, Netanyahu, accompanied via video call by other Israeli military officials, including the intelligence chief, that is the head of the Mossad. And the Israelis made the case in that meeting for war with Iran, laying out possible scenarios and concluding that victory was all but guaranteed. Now, Netanyahu has, of course, made an unprecedented number of trips to the U.S. since Trump came to power, 7 months, 7 visits in the last 14 months. That's, of course, on average, once every 2 months. So if you could give an assessment of your sense of to what extent this war was may have been driven by Israel and whether Israel's intentions coincided exactly or more or less exactly with the U.S., which is why the U.S. ultimately went along with Israel.
Well, I think, I mean, there has, you know, we have to look at the structural context. So, I mean, really since the Carter administration and the Iranian Revolution, we have seen this ongoing massive militarization of the Persian Gulf region. I mean, just this proliferation of US bases throughout various Persian Gulf states, actually the states in the Persian Gulf sort of tells you the degree to which the region has been militarized. And a lot of this was actually to contain both Iran and then, you know, previously Iraq. We obviously have the really atrocious legacy of the Iraq War, which again was very much a sort of a war of regime change to very much transform the region in the image of the United States and Israel. And I think these were driven by, obviously, by American imperial imperatives. I mean, the fact that all these sort of American military assets in the region, of course, Israel is set to benefit, obviously, and it has been the beneficiary, really. And what I think really what we're seeing, obviously, since October 7th, is that basically all guardrails have been removed. And we see very much kind of an alignment between the United States and the Israeli state in order to really conclusively enshrine Israeli domination of the entire region, where it has complete freedom of action to carry out genocide, ethnic cleansing, attacks on Lebanon, southern Lebanon, and then pursuing again another sort of campaign of ethnic cleansing there as well in the south, as well as freedom of action in Iran. And Iran is often seen as, I mean, is seen as the last, as it were, obstacle to both Israeli and American domination. So I have no doubt that Benjamin Netanyahu did exercise, you know, significant influence in pushing the Trump administration in order to do this. And he is, you know, like as you said, every other month he's visiting Washington. It's really kind of unprecedented. But I guess what we're really seeing is a classic case, very much supported by the Israeli state and advocated by the Israeli state, of U.S. imperial hubris, really, and groupthink, whereby, you know, the Trump administration, President Trump himself, has really surrounded himself with sycophants, for the most part, who aren't really willing to challenge him on something that he is really obviously committed to. And I think, you know, coming off the kidnapping of Nicolas Maduro and obviously the attack on Venezuela, he clearly believed and he was clearly influenced and he clearly wanted to believe, and this is why I say groupthink is important, he clearly wanted to believe that this would be similarly straightforward. And you know, you could argue that he thought this because he's basically been, by both the sort of the corporate media and Fox News and so on, has been told that he can do this. And previously, obviously, he has done things with minimal consequence. So we can think about the assassination of Qasem Soleimani in January 2020. There wasn't sort of significant repercussions for that. Similarly, when he attacked Iran's nuclear installations most recently, I mean, there wasn't massive fallout over this. And it really is only when sort of the Islamic Republic sensed that there was really an existential threat that it started to move to both, you know, horizontal escalation, so attacks on the Gulf states and their sort of crucial energy infrastructure, as well as closing the Strait of Hormuz. And I mean, if we believe the reporting in the New York Times, and of course we should take that with a pinch of salt, there clearly was the impression that this would be a cakewalk. And this wasn't simply just this was being sold by the Israelis, which of course it was. And there might be even somewhat of divergence there. So maybe the Israelis did actually believe that this would lead to regime change and the installation of the former Shah's son and so on. Or they tried to at least market that. But it seems that the Trump administration or President Trump himself wasn't particularly enamored of that. But he did think that he could provoke regime collapse and basically maybe do some sort of deal with the rump, the remnants of the Islamic Republic. So I wouldn't say that they completely, we shouldn't entirely conflate them, and we should look at the longer arc of sort of American imperialism in the region. But yes, of course, Israel does play, I think the specific decision to take this action was obviously very much significantly influenced by Benjamin Netanyahu in particular, who, yeah, has been. I mean, he's been basically portraying Iran as the ultimate bogeyman of the region for decades and decades, and he has been lobbying for this his entire career.
So just before we wrap, Professor Sohrabi, if you could tell us, just to go back to the situation inside Iran, number one, the question of communications, how people in the country are communicating with one another and with those outside, net blocks. The Global Monitor reported Sunday that the state-imposed near-total internet shutdown is now the longest nationwide blackout on record in history, and also the reports of an increasing number of executions within Iran. We have about a minute.
Yeah, so basically, as you said, on February 28th, the Iranian government shut down modes of communication. Basically, you can't call into the country. It's very, very hard to. People can buy little packets of phone cards where they can call out, and that's unstable. Internet, basically, there's something called the national internet inside Iran, so they have their own apps. They can communicate within that, but that is actually monitored, so everybody is very careful about what what they say, but they can't get out with it. It's very, very hard to, again, going back to the economic situation, talking about black markets, which Professor Saideri also mentioned, a black market of proxy configurations has developed. These are very, very expensive, but they allow you to break through the internet blockage that you mentioned, but it costs a lot of money. So in a circumstance in which we're talking about the unequalness of the economic disparity within Iran is now showing itself in terms of who gets to connect with the outside world and who can't. In terms of the execution, it's really important to remember when we talk about how the region, how Iran has changed and how it has withstood imperial forces. One of the ways in which it's done that is that it's actually doubled down on its internal repression. It has been executing protesters that it arrested in January. It has continued to arrest people despite war conditions for a variety of reasons. And it's really important to remember that while the Islamic Republic before the war was not okay with protesters, it had a language in which it distinguished between protest and rioting. What the war has done is that it's allowed this now empowered state to turn protests, all of it, into fifth columns. And it's going to now, and then they have announced it, they talked about it, the head of the judiciary 2 days ago, that they're going to continue executing people and they're going to continue confiscating their property in the name of, now it's treason. So you have a new word for it. It was protest, rioting, and now trying to claw some space out of this world that Iranians live in is now going to be called treason and dealt with accordingly.
Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Naghmeh Sohrabi, Professor of Middle East History at Brandeis University, and Professor Askander Saideri Burujerdi, Assistant Professor of International Relations of the Middle East at the University of St. Andrews. Thank you both so much for being with us. When we come back, we'll be joined by the award-winning directors Carl Diehl and Tia Lesson talking about their new documentary about Democracy Now! And our very own Amy Goodman called Steal This Story, Please. Stay with us. Have the Power, Patti Smith performing at Democracy Now!'s 30th anniversary celebration along with Bruce Springsteen, Michael Stipe, and more. You can see the whole celebration on our website at democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. We end today's show with a look at the new documentary about Democracy Now! And the life and career of our very own Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Just celebrated its 30th anniversary at Riverside Church in New York last month. Well, 30 years ago, Amy, along with co-host Juan Gonzalez and Pacifica Radio, launched Democracy Now! As the only daily election show in public broadcasting in 1996. It grew from 9 community radio stations, expanding to television as well the week of the 9/11 attacks in 2001. It's now on 1,500 public television and radio stations across the country and around the world. The film is called Steal This Story, Please. And here's the film's trailer.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! Right. Can you tell us what you think about President Trump saying climate change is a Chinese hoax?
I'm sorry, I'm running late for a meeting.
Right, but you weren't running late when you're just standing there, so.
my first impressions of Amy.
What did you say to those who say that you're a war criminal?
Man, she doesn't care what anybody thinks.
Well, don't push me. I'm a journalist here.
Independent media is the oxygen of a democracy.
What do you mean by independent?
Not being sponsored by corporations.
Amy's chaotically brilliant at the spy game.
We began on 9 radio stations.
If she believes something, she's going to fight for it and get it out to the world. Straight up journalism.
It came from my Jewish education that you ask questions.
Sharif, can you talk about what's happened on the Gaza Strip?
From Ground Zero, from East Timor,
as we deplane in Haiti,
from Georgia's death row prison.
We had to smuggle in our recording equipment. This was extremely dangerous. We're accusing a powerful American corporation of murder.
Without any warning, military opened fire on the protesters. They put the guns to our heads. It is critical that we expose what is done in our name.
Donald Trump understood corporate owners of the media would do anything for money.
She taught me, speak to the people at the target's end of the bomb. Speak to those who are being deliberately silenced.
When you hear someone speak, it's less likely you'll want to destroy them.
We expand the frame and center those voices.
There is a great force that would like to silence us.
The press is the enemy of the people.
We're not the only thing to
Allah. No, we're not going to let it happen.
That's a trailer for the new independent documentary about Democracy Now! And the life and career of Amy Goodman. It's called Steal This Story, Please! And opens in theaters in New York this week. The film was directed by the Oscar-nominated filmmakers Carl Diehl and Tia Leson, known for their previous films Trouble the Water and Citizen Coke, also longtime producers for Michael Moore. Tia also won 3 Emmys for her film The Janes. Executive producers of Steal This Story, Please! Include Jane Fonda, Rosario Dawson, and musician Tom Morello. The documentary has won over a dozen audience favorite and jury prizes at major film festivals around the country. Its theatrical release begins Friday in New York, here at the IFC Center, and expands to theaters across the country. Carl and Tia now join me in our studio. Carl, why don't you begin by telling us what prompted you to make a film about Democracy Now! And Amy?
Well, thank you, Nirmeen, for having us here. We're really happy to be here. We're grateful for all the people on the other side of the glass behind you there and all the great work that Democracy Now! Has been doing over the last 30 years. So happy anniversary and congratulations. You know, what Democracy Now! Has been doing and what Amy has been leading this effort bringing stories in from the ground, the stories that we're not going to hear, that are shut out of the mainstream quite frequently. And it's not lost on me today, listening to your guests today in the studio, talking about Iran. When you contrast what you just presented to your audience with what we're seeing in the headlines today, the headlines in the mainstream press right now, the commercial media, are all about, you know, what's going to happen to oil prices now, who won and who lost, or who won, not even who lost. And you're presenting another side of this, of the sort of the brutality and the cruelty of this attack on civilian infrastructure. And so, you know, that's kind of a key difference between what happens here and what happens elsewhere. And it's because you're independent. So for us as independent filmmakers, we've been doing this for decades, and we've always tried to work a little bit out of the mainstream and have always admired what Amy has done. And so for us, it was a no-brainer when she consented to let us follow her around for the last couple of years, which was an exhausting endeavor. For us, it was an opportunity to say something in this really critical moment.
Mm-hmm. And Tia, if we could, as we mentioned, the film has won multiple audience awards around festivals around the country. So if you could say more about how the film has been received by audiences and indeed by critics, it seems to have received excellent reviews.
Well, thank you, Nermeen. Yeah, you know, look, some would have you believe that the only nonfiction storytelling that audiences are interested in
you know, is true crime stories and celebrity profiles. And, you know, we think they're wrong. And I think our experience so far to date with this film proves that. And we're looking forward to continuing to bear that out in the theatrical release. You know, people want to see and read and hear content that speaks to this grave political moment. And, you know, this film does just that.
Okay, well, let's go to more of the film. These are other clips from Steal the Story, Please. In 1991, Amy and fellow journalist Alan Nairn witnessed and survived a massacre carried out by the U.S.-backed Indonesian military against civilians in East Timor. They then, Alan and Amy, reported on the massacre.
A group of soldiers surrounded us. They beat me to the ground. Alan threw himself on top of me to protect me. And they used their US M16s like baseball bats, and they slammed them against his skull. They put the guns to our heads.
Western reporters witnessing this was a problem for them. They killed more than 270 Timorese on that day. This is a day I'll never forget for the rest of my life. I live with every single day. If we could somehow report it to the outside world, maybe that would be a way for the killing to stop.
That was a clip from Steal the Story, Please, from 1991. In this next clip, Amy takes a call from President Bill Clinton on Election Day 2000.
One thing that I just have seen Amy do over and over and over
Mr.
again.
Mr. Mayor, we all packed in there to ask you questions.
He's going to trip.
It's okay. I'm from New York.
If she has zeroed in on a target, she always finds a way to ask the questions no one else will ask, whether it's powerful corporate people or the president of the United States.
$25, $30 gets you the DVD of our Sunday night event as we talked about independent media in a time of elections.
It's Election Day 2000. This is the presidential race between George W. Bush and Al Gore. We got a call. I thought they said the White Horse calling. That's a historic bar in Greenwich Village where Dylan Thomas drank himself to death. And they said, the president would like to speak to you. I said, the president of what? And they said, the president of the United States. Oh, the White House, not the White Horse. So we go running into Master Control, and it's an alternative Latino music show. Gonzalo Berto is at the controls. You hear salsa music loud, and underneath it all, President Clinton is saying, hello, hello, is anyone there?
Mr. President, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
You're calling radio stations to tell people to get out and vote. What do you say to people who feel that the two parties are bought by corporations and that their vote doesn't make a difference?
There's not a shred of evidence to support that. That's what I would say. It's true that both parties have wealthy supporters, but
it was very interesting talking to the leader of the free world.
So that's obviously an extraordinary moment. If you could talk, Tia, about the significance of this documentary coming out during the Trump administration and increasing crackdown on media in general and on independent media in particular.
Well, that's right. Yeah, I mean, look, we saw in 1996 the Telecommunication Act accelerated the consolidation of media, and that has really, you know, been chilling at this moment. There's so many journalists out there that want to report the news, that want to, you know, aggressively ask the questions, and they are compromised, and they are censored, and they are silenced by their own networks that are trying to curry favor with the Trump administration, with corporate sponsors. And one of the remarkable things that you know, we think of in terms of Amy's coverage over the years and Democracy Now! Is that it is not it's accountable only to its listeners. It's not accountable to corporate sponsors. It's not, you know, beholden to government funding. And that's what makes you guys really different and so refreshing right now.
And we have just 20 seconds, but talk about the significance of independently distributing this film.
Well, that's right. We're actually going to be in about 80 art house theaters across the country. They're mostly nonprofits. We are a nonprofit distribution company that's putting out this film. It is a time when, you know, Amazon, controlled by Jeff Bezos and Paramount, you know, controlled by the Ellison family, they're not taking, you know, films like these. And so we're excited about, you know, getting it out directly to audiences, and we are looking forward to meeting folks on the road.
We're going to have to leave it there. Carl Diehl, Tia Leslin, award-winning filmmakers. We all look forward to seeing the film in theaters. To find out where it's playing, go to stealthisstory.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
PFLAG Canada is there when it seems no one else is. Did you know that LGBT students hear anti-gay slurs an average of 26 times a day? One out of every four LGBT youth are told to leave home. LGBT youth are more likely to be homeless. 30% of suicides are LGBT. PFLAG is committed to anyone struggling with sexual orientation and gender identity issues. PFLAG Canada supports, educates, and provides resources 24/7. Visit pflagcanada.ca.
Do you like music, or do you like technology, or do you like talking to people? CGS